Okay, if you've got a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 11. If you don't have a Bible, you should find one in your pews. Grab that one. If you don't own a Bible, just write your name in that one. It's a little gift from us to you. We encourage you to read it. We genuinely think it'll change your life. And we're going to look at Matthew chapter 11. I want to read to you the words of Jesus himself. We're going to be reading in the Message translation. So these are Jesus' words with a little twist from Eugene Peterson, the author of the Message translation. So Jesus/Eugene says, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion?" Let's just stop there. You tired, worn out, burned out on religion? We won't ask for show of hands, don't worry. But rather than just sort of reading this text and not actually engaging with the text, let's do something radical and actually engage with the text. So imagine Jesus was present, and we believe he is present by his spirit, and was asking you the question, hey, you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? And my hunch is a number of you would be like, yeah, I'm just tired. I'm spent. I've been trying to do good and do right, and then I keep screwing things up, and I'm frustrated, and I'm spiritually experiencing a sense of fatigue. Well, Jesus has some insanely good news for you. Let's carry on reading. Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me, work with me, watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. These were words spoken to Jesus' disciples, and they're just phenomenally good news, and they're words spoken to you and I. And the NIV translation, the translation that many in the room, I'm guessing, will be more familiar with, Jesus says, you know, come to me. And then his ending phrase, verse 30, is, "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now, if you grew up going to church, you know, as a whippersnapper, and you were probably taught texts like this, because it's one of the key sayings of Jesus. If you're anything like me, you knew this text, and you knew it was profound, because everyone said, this is really profound. But you had no idea why it was profound. Like, as a young kid, it was like, okay, I get it. Like, Jesus says, come to me, and he says that his yoke is easy, his burden is I don't get why, like, egg yolks, and Jesus, and burdens, like, why is that profound in any way whatsoever? This, like, makes no sense. So I'm guessing there'll be some in the room that read that kind of phrase, my yoke is easy, my burden is light, and think, what on earth is going on? Now, you need to know, if you want to understand the verse, that in the first century, there was a number of different rabbis, and different rabbis had different ways of interpreting the Jewish law, the Torah, the Ten Commandments, and all the other little Jewish laws. And for some rabbis, their interpretation of the Torah was just really hard to live up to. You know, so certain commands like keep the Sabbath holy, well, they would interpret that and say, well, to keep the Sabbath holy, you can't do X, Y, Z. You can do some of these things, but you can't do any of those things. And other rabbis would say, well, I interpret that text and that law slightly differently. In my interpretation, you can do X, Y, Z, but you can't do these things. And each rabbi would have their own way of interpreting their law, the law, and their interpretation of the Torah was known as their yoke. So for some rabbis, you'd be like, oh, wow, their yoke, it's impossible to live up to. If you try and follow those guys, you were going to burn out big time. You're going to crash and burn. But that rabbi is a little bit more gentle. And Jesus comes along living this fullness of life example to them. And he says to the disciples, like, I can see you're burnt out following these different interpretations of the Torah. Like, you're done in, like, come to me, and I'm going to show you a different way, because my yoke, my way of interpreting the Torah, it's easy. It's not going to be putting something on your back that's going to break your back. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. And I'm guessing the disciples are like, oh, we've been wanting an easier way to do life. We want to live life fully. So this next 4 weeks is going to be a mini series entitled Rhythms of Grace, because Jesus said to the disciples, I'm going to teach you these unforced rhythms of grace so that you can recover your life and live it to the full. So we're going to be looking at spiritual disciplines, and I'm aware that even using that language, some of you are like, oh gosh, disciplines and they're spiritual. That's a horrible combination. But I want you to think of spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices as like putting boundaries around your life, a fence around your life so that you can live life fully. So think of the Ten Commandments, the Jewish Torah, the law. we've kind of got a misunderstanding of how the Torah works, because sometimes we think of the law as like a really bad thing that Jesus came to do away with so that we could experience grace. That's not what's going on in the Old Testament whatsoever. The law for the Jewish people was seen as a phenomenal gift from God. He'd rescued his people from Egypt, placed them in this beautiful land, and said, I'm going to put like some boundary markers around you, like a fence around you. And if you stay within the fence, you're going to experience fullness of life. You're going to experience relationship with me, and all the blessings that come from me will flow to you, and you'll live life fully. And they're like, that's amazing. Thank you. So what were some of the laws? Well, one of them was like, don't kill each other. You know, in our kind of perimeter fence, other nations have different understandings, but within this fence, it's really hard for people to flourish where there's murder. So I'm telling you, like, try not to kill each other. And like within this fence, and again, other nations have different ways of, you know, doing the law, but within this fence, don't sleep with each other's husbands and wives, because it breaks people's heart and it messes them up. And maybe try not to lie and not to steal, and don't embrace envy as a way of life. And suddenly you've got all these commands, which is God gifting his people with a way of living so that they can embrace the fullness of life they were made for. I think spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices function a little bit like that. It's like banging in a fence around you to protect you from some of the destructive forces that are at work in the culture around us. So we're going to look at fasting and feasting as a way of like sort of pushing back against this culture of consumerism and materialism. And I need more, I need more. We're going to look at gratitude and generosity, overcoming the spirit of greed. We're going to look at service and submission, pushing back against a culture that celebrates narcissism and everything being about you. And suddenly when you learn to serve other people, you push back on that culture. And today we're going to look at the Sabbath. This unforced rhythm of grace by which we learn to rest and find working in a different way because it comes from a place of rest. So the Hebrew word for Sabbath is Shabbat. It sounds a little bit like Shabbat, but with the T on the end, so Shabbat. And the word is a synonym with the Hebrew word Shalom. Peace. Now, whenever our Bibles translate shalom, the Hebrew word, it always says peace. But that's kind of not fully, you know, sufficient for an interpretation. The word actually means like fullness of life, wholeness, wellness. And because these words are synonyms, the point seems to be that if you want to live life fully, if you want to know this peace, this shalom, then you need to observe the Sabbath, Shabbat. So I want you to consider the Sabbath like a gift from God to you. Now, God's a loving father, right? He loves without strings attached. So when he gives gifts, he's not kind of giving it and saying, you must open it, you must enjoy it. So this isn't a rule by which you get close to God. There's no space for that way of thinking. This is a gift, and God says, it's from me. I think this gift is going to bring phenomenal life to you. So I'd really encourage you to open it. You don't have to. I won't love you less if you don't. I encourage you to open it. There'll be many people in the room that you don't observe a Sabbath. You don't have a full day of rest. You've not opened this gift that God has given you. And I just, as a friend, as a pastor, someone that loves you, want to say you're massively missing out. This is a gift that leads to shalom, to fullness. So I'd encourage you to open it for a number of reasons. So let's look at what you'll find inside of the box. Three things I want to unpack. Number one, Sabbath is a gift of rest. As I said, some of you in the room are knackered right now. And God's word to you is, come to me if you're weary, and I'll give you like a proper rest. And there's three reasons why rest is so important. Number one, rest reminds you that you are free. Rest reminds you that you are free. There's two versions of the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament. One of them's in Exodus chapter 20, I think, and we'll get to it later. But the second version, which is slightly different, is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And this is how it reads. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Shabbat, Sabbath, to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your ox or your donkey or any of your animals, nor the alien within your gates. so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. And here's the key verse. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath. Really simple logic here. God's saying, I want you to observe the Sabbath because it reminds you that you were free. That you were free. You were once slaves in Egypt, but I did everything necessary to rescue you from oppression so that you can now be free. If you remember back to slavery in Egypt, you didn't have a day off. Like, you were beaten day in, day out with whips. Work harder. Build more bricks. Build more bricks. That's what they were doing as slaves in Egypt, building this phenomenal empire that the Egyptians could be proud of. And God says, remember what that was like? Sucked, right? And I rescued you so that you could taste freedom. And so that you never go back that way, at least in your heart, I want you to observe this one day where you can taste freedom. That no one's oppressing you. Going too fast. Going way too fast. That you are free. That's the most incredible gift. So firstly, rest, the Sabbath, reminds you that you are free. Secondly, rest reminds you that God is in control. Most of us are control freaks, right? I won't ask for a show of hands. But most of us battle with trying to control the uncontrollable. Sociologists tell us that basically 10% of our lives are actually within our grasp. We have control of 10% of our lives. 90% is beyond your grasp. So your 10%, how you and your family are living and your work rhythm, but then you go through things that remind you, oh my goodness, I'm not in control. Sickness comes from left field. Something awful happens to a loved one. Maybe something at a global scale happens that's beyond your control, but it massively impacts your life. Something changes in your workplace and you're made redundant, and suddenly you're reminded, I'm not actually in control. And chronic anxiety actually comes, sociologists will tell us, from trying to control the 90%. Trying to basically grab hold of that which is beyond your grasp, and suddenly you begin to feel powerless. So here's the phenomenally good news that comes through Jesus. Like, God is in control, and he invites you to rest. And in doing so, remember that he's active even when you're inactive. Like, some of us struggle to sleep. There's so much on our mind, and we don't quite know what to do about the next day. And God would basically say, chill out, because when you sleep, I'm still at work bringing about my will. I want you to sleep and sleep well. Listen to Deuteronomy 5 again. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. The question underneath that text seems to be, what did you contribute to your salvation? You know, when you were being oppressed by the Egyptians, what did you contribute? And the answer is like, nothing. Oh, you know, the 10 plagues, what did you contribute towards the 10 plagues? Nothing. And when you stood in front of the Red Sea and you could hear the Egyptian army bearing down on you, what did you contribute to that moment of rescue? Nothing. And when you're in the wilderness and you were starving and thirsty, what did you contribute to provide manna from heaven? Nothing. And what did you contribute when I overcame sort of the enemies in the land and drove them out so you could find rest in this beautiful land, the promised land? Nothing. Do you get the point that God is saying it was all grace? I did everything necessary to rescue you and to win your freedom. I'm in control. You're not in control. I am in control. Similarly, what did you contribute to Christ's rescue plan? And the answer is like, nothing. Paul says, while you were still sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. Everything is an act of grace, but you have to receive that grace. And as you receive that grace, it brings you to life. There's a Chinese church leader and theologian from the last century called Watchman Nee, and he wrote loads of brilliant commentaries, but one commentary on the book of Ephesians is called Sit, Walk, Stand, and he basically walks through the book of Ephesians and says, if you want to understand Ephesians, you've got to look at these three verbs that are used repetitively by Paul throughout this little book. He talks regularly about being seated, with Christ in the heavenlies. And then he talks about walking by the Spirit or walking with Christ. And then he begins to talk about standing against the enemy, the evil one. You are seated with Christ. Then you begin to walk out your salvation. And then you learn to stand and resist the plans of the evil one. Sit, walk, stand. And he just walks you through Ephesians in the most incredible way. But the point he makes to begin with is that our first posture when we come to Christ is we are seated. Like, it's just gift. Doesn't ask us to do anything. You know, the first command isn't walk this out. You know, if you want to follow me, you're going to have to do X, Y, Z to impress me. No, the first thing is you are seated. Posture of rest. Some of us really hate that posture. We've forgotten how to rest. But Paul would say the first posture of the Christian is you are seated. Just so that you can receive and enjoy relationship. Only then can you walk it out. And he gives this, like, really bizarre illustration. But he talks about how in the Navy, in the sort of like First and Second World War, if someone was drowning at sea, you were taught to rescue those that were drowning. And you had two options if you wanted to rescue someone. The first is you would wait and watch them drown. And only when they'd given up the fight, like they'd stopped like splashing around, only when they'd given up the fight, you would then swim in and rescue them. The second one option is a bit more hardcore. You'd swim up to them, give them a very heavy blow to the head and knock them out. And then you would rescue them back to the boat or back to dry land. What they were told is never try and rescue someone who's trying to save themselves. Because the likelihood is they're going to kill you rather than you rescuing them. In their desperation to survive, they're going to grab hold of you and you're going to get caught up in the tussle. You're more likely to lose than rescue them. So you knock them out or you wait until they've given up the fight. And it's a powerful image. But this is what I want to say from it, is that God has rescued us and invited us to take this posture of being seated with Christ in the heavenlies. But some of us are still experiencing trauma, you know, or a financial situation or a relational situation, and you're fighting to try and save yourself. If you want to experience salvation, rest. If you want God to intervene in your life and do something spectacular, how about a Sabbath? It's much harder for God to rescue people trying to rescue themselves. So stop fighting. And one of the ways you stop fighting is you say, take a Sabbath and you remind yourself, I'm not actually in control. I believe that God is in control and he's powerful to save. So rest reminds us that God is in control. He's the rescuer. We are not. Thirdly, then, rest reminds us that we're loved for who we are, not what we achieve. Most of us deep down believe in our brokenness that we're loved according to our achievements and our productivity. The more we achieve, the more success we taste, the more lovable that makes us to those around us. So we are loved in proportion to our success. In other words, it's all about productivity. And if you worship the idol of productivity, and you'll know if you do, by the way, because you'll regularly say things like this, oh, how was your day? And your response will be, I've had a great day. So productive. Oh, I got so much done. Great day. Great day. Or, how was your day? Awful day. So unproductive. I mean, so unproductive. I find myself doing this all of the time. In other words, my day is as good as I've been productive. In other words, I'm defined by my productivity. And if you worship the idol of productivity, it's going to break your heart. C.S. Lewis said, idols always break the hearts of their worshippers. So if you bring your identity and well-being to the idol of productivity, you need to know you're free to do that because God's given you free will. You're free to do it. It will break your heart and destroy your soul. So don't bow down to the idol of productivity. And one of the ways you push back is observing the Sabbath. There's an amazing film called Chariots of Fire. Anyone seen Chariots of Fire? It's probably used more in sermon illustrations than any other film ever made. So I feel obliged at least once a year to use it as an illustration. And it's basically a film about this Scottish sprinter, Eric Liddell. Some pronounce that Liddell. And this Scottish sprinter, an amazing Christian guy, he refused to run on the Sabbath because he believed that you should observe the Sabbath because the Lord said it was holy. Now, in the 1924 Olympics, he was a phenomenally fast sprinter, was a shoo-in for gold for Great Britain. And he got through, you know, all of the rounds, and then came the Olympic Games itself, 1924. And when the schedule came out for the 100-meter sprint, which was his race, it fell, the final of it fell on the Sabbath. which left him with this dilemma, like, oh, balls. He probably didn't say that. Like, what do I do? And his friends, even his Christian friends, were saying, God would understand. Run. We need you to run. We want a gold. We need you to run. But there was this wrestling within of like, but I've said as a kind of a promise to God that I'll observe the Sabbath and I'll keep it holy. And then the kind of authorities, like those overseeing the games, at least from a GB point of view, were like, you got to run. You got to run. And he eventually said, I'm not going to run. I'm not going to run. And he put himself in for the 400 meters. Now, many of you will know a 100 meter sprint, like 10 second dash, is very different to a 400 meters race, right? 400 meters is about endurance and like going fast, but going fast for a long time. So he put himself into a race that wasn't his, you know, expertise, wasn't in that race, and he won gold. And it's totally, totally remarkable. But the point of the story that I want to tell you about is there was another sprinter, a GB sprinter called Harold Abrahams. He was an English guy. And for Harold Abrahams, there was this like drivenness, this idol of success and productivity. So there was a fragility to his ego, and winning gold was everything. And he knew if he didn't win gold, he'd feel like a failure, and failure would destroy him. So he had to win gold. He had to win gold. And you've got these moments that compare the lifestyle of Eric Liddell with the lifestyle of Harold Abrahams, and this kind of like peace versus this drivenness. And Eric Liddell says things like, I just love running, and when I run, I feel God's pleasure. So whether I win or lose, I just get this buzz, this sense of fulfillment of God's pleasure when I run. And listen to this quote from Harold Abrahams as a comparison. He said this: when I run, I have 10 seconds to justify my existence. When I run, I feel God's pleasure. When I run, I have 10 seconds to justify my existence. Now, how many in the room could fill in that phrase, your own version? When I work, when I'm in business, I've got X to justify my existence. I've got to hit this target. I've got to get these results in my exams. I've got to perform this level to justify my existence. And there's an exhaustion that comes from that mindset. My hunch is many in the room right now, you're exhausted, because you were bowing the knee to the idol of productivity. And C.S. Lewis would say, idols always break the hearts of their worshippers. Once a month, I go on retreat, and I just have a day to be intentionally unproductive, because I really struggle with bowing down to the idol of productivity. So once a month, I take a day out, and I'm very intentionally unproductive. And it's taken me quite a long time to learn how to do this. And when we started the church here at KXC, I decided that I'd get into this rhythm. And my first retreat day, I booked this kind of pastinia, which is this little hut out in Harrow, where you've got like a bed, you've got a desk where you can study, and that's it. A little kettle in the corner. And then you can walk around in this kind of like wild garden. So I got there, turned my phone off, and I was super tired because planning a church is pretty full on and we'd been going at such a pace. And I got there and I was like, do you know what? I'm so spent. I want to study today some scripture and some books, and I've got a lot that I want to think about in terms of the life of KXC, but I'm going to treat myself to 10-minute snooze, because it's hard to study when you're knackered and it's hard to think clearly when you're tired. So like 10 minutes, it won't be more than that. 10-minute shut-eye. I'll wake up, feel refreshed, and I'll crack on, and I'll read, and I'll think, and I'll walk in some gardens and meet with God. So I lie down on the bed, and I shut my eyes, and then I wake up. I look at my clock. And it, you know when you wake up with that sense of, like, something's not right? Like, that can't have been 10 minutes. And I felt groggy, and I was like, ugh, I feel dirty. 3 hours? 3 hours? And I only had about an hour or two left of my retreat day. And so I thought, well, I've got to condense everything that I plan to do in 2 hours. So I tried to read furiously some material, and I tried to do some thinking, and I ran around this wild garden. I'm exaggerating to make the point. And then I got in the car because I had to get home to sort of pick up Benj from something he was at. And you know when you're stressed and you're in London traffic? Oh, that is hell, isn't it? Do you know what I'm talking about? When you're already stressed and you're in traffic and everyone around you is just winding you up a treat. like the person on your right who's singing, they're happy that they're in traffic, and that person's winding me up right now. And the person in front who keeps stopping for way too long, even though the traffic's moved on in front of them, and you're like, some of us are in a rush. I was getting more and more frustrated, and I have this moment where I almost feel God just speak something into my heart. Not like an audible voice moment, just a little thought that didn't feel like it was one of my thoughts. And I felt God was saying something like, it was my pleasure. To which my response was, what was your pleasure? That doesn't make any sense. And I was feeling really guilty about this day I'd set aside for rest, equivalent of a Sabbath, and I'd slept and been unproductive, and I was beating myself up. And I felt God say, it was my pleasure. You didn't actually need to study those books. And all that thinking that you'd planned, that wasn't really the priority. You were really tired, and my gift to you was rest. So I wanted to give you a sleep. You planned 10 minutes. I planned 3 hours. I thought that's what you need. This is kind of the dialogue within my head. And it was this sense of, oh my goodness, I'm not loved according to my productivity. I'm just freely loved by God. That mindset totally, totally transforms your life. Some of you, the most important rhythm you can put in as we go through this series, the most important unforced rhythm of grace that you can establish is the Sabbath. It's just choose a day. It doesn't have to be Sunday. Mine's Friday because I work Sundays. Choose a day where you are intentionally unproductive to kill off the idol of productivity in your life. You build a fence around these destructive forces of workaholism and all these lies that come with that. So number one, Sabbath is a gift of rest. Number two, Sabbath is a gift of relationship. So I said there's two versions of the Ten Commandments. Here's the other version, Exodus chapter 20. It's slightly different. You'll notice. Remember the Sabbath by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. And it lists all these random things, all these random groups that won't do any work. Verse 11, here's the change. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. The other version, the writer says, remember the Sabbath. Because once you were slaves and now you are free. So the backdrop to that text is redemption. The backdrop to this text isn't redemption, it's creation. It's not remember that you are slaves, it was remember how God created the heavens and the earth. Like, where did you come in the order of things? The previous question was, what did you contribute to your redemption? Nothing. Correct. The question here is, what did you contribute to your creation? Nothing. Correct. All grace. All gift. Adam and Eve created on the final day, on the sixth day, so that the seventh day would be a day of rest. So all the work was done. God had, you know, separated the waters to reveal dry land. He'd created the trees. He'd put the sun and moon and stars in place. And he'd put the vegetation out and created all the animals. And Adam and Eve arrived. And I can imagine their question was, like, what do you want us to do? God said, nothing. I've done it all. I've created you, the pinnacle of the creation, to be, you know, made in my image and likeness. But the main reason for your existence, raison d'etre, is relationship. Like, I've got some stuff that I want to invite you into, but I didn't make you to do stuff. I made you for relationship, to love and to love me in return so that we can hang out and be friends. How incredible is that? Like, do any of you have friends that whenever they phone you, you know they need something? Like, you see their name on your phone, you're like, oh, what is it? Is that just me? Maybe that's just me. That's awkward. But they never phone to see how you're doing. They never phone for conversation. Like, maybe you hardly ever speak to them once every 4 months. And then they phone, you're like, they need something. And you basically pick up the phone and be like, hey there, what do you need? And they're like, oh, I was just phoning to hang out and sort of see how you're doing. And you're like, you never phone to see how I'm doing. Like, what do you need? So honestly, like, is everything all right? Financial crisis? Has there been a relational breakdown? You know, what's going on? They're like, oh, sorry. Yeah, but there is this one thing. And then they basically roll on. And those people, you're like, oh, they always engage with me from a basis of need. Some of us honestly relate to God like that. When God speaks, we get this like, oh no, he needs me to do something. He needs me to chat to that person or stand up for this cause in my workplace. He needs me to do X, Y, Z. Most of the time when God gets in touch and wants to speak to you, he just wants to hang out. Have you thought of that? That's what we read of in the creation story. He creates Adam and Eve for relationship. Just wants to hang out. He rescues the nation of Israel. Yes, he has a job for them to do, but the primary thing, he rescued them to hang out so that they could be his treasured possession. Relationship always comes first in the kingdom of God. So we enjoy the Sabbath because we want to enjoy intimacy with God. Think of the Sabbath like an anniversary, like a special day that you set apart for the sake of relationship. So B and I, we've been married like 13 years now. There's only one person that whooped, but that meant a lot. So one of our low points, toughest years maybe in marriage, came just before we planted KXC. And it was a really tough year for many reasons, but the main reason was B went through a really brutal illness. And it lasted for best part of a year. And for most of that year, she was in bed, just completely exhausted and suffering with this dizziness that we now know is labyrinthitis, that it would create this sickness and migraines, and it was just a brutal year, and most of the year was in bed. And we saw so many specialists during that year. You know, you start with the doctor, and the doctor moves you on to this person, and to begin with, we started meeting with neurologists. They thought it might be something in the brain that they needed to investigate, and whenever you go and see a neurologist, you're panicking, right? Like, what's going on? You do a Google search. And you panic. And we saw the neurologist and had loads of tests. And the neurologist basically said, I don't think this is in your brain, but I detected something like a heart murmur. We think there might be a problem with B's heart. So you need to see a cardiologist, which is never good news, right? So you're like, oh gosh, like the good news is not the brain. The bad news, there might be something wrong with the heart. So we went to see this cardiologist. And all this time, B was really sick and we were really panicking. We were praying hard and it was like, God, please would you do something? And the cardiologist did all the tests, said it's not anything to do with the heart. And it remained in this kind of undiagnosed category, which in many ways is more stressful. Anyway, in the middle of that year, we had our anniversary. And it's like, well, we've got to make something of this day because this year sucks right now. So I kind of like phoned my mum up and said, look, I want to do something really special. We can't really go out because B's like exhausted. But like, this is my plan. I just want to run it by you and see what you think. And I was like, well, what I'll do is I'll buy some really beautiful flowers, like the most expensive flowers you can buy in the co-op. And I'll basically, I'll give them to B. I'll take the co-op sticker off and say they're from M&S, but I'll start with flowers and I'll make breakfast in bed and we'll just have a beautiful morning, just relax, and then lunch we'll do something simple, maybe some soup and roll, and I'll give B this gift. And I can't even remember what the gift was, but I thought I want to get something really special. And then for the evening, again, because B was exhausted, I thought, well, we won't go out, but I'll cook a really nice meal and we'll watch a movie, and that will be the way that we mark out our anniversary. Anyway, we had an amazing day. We had the flowers and the breakfast and then chill out and then lunch, chill out. And then it got to the meal and I was like, well, what do I do? And B, and I'm sure everyone, when you're feeling really rough, has that kind of go-to meal. You know it isn't great nutritionally, but it's just a comforting meal. And for B back then, the go-to meal, if feeling really rough, was fish fingers, baked beans and ketchup. Don't judge her. Some of you are even worse. So I thought, well, I said to Mum that I'll cook a really nice meal, but I know what B really wants is fish fingers, ketchup, and some baked beans. So I basically cooked that meal. She's denying this. With chips. I didn't do the chips. So I fell short. Didn't have the chips. Anyway, so I cooked it all. And we just had a brilliant day. And at the end of the evening, my mum phoned me and basically said, so how was the special day? How were the flowers? I was like, yeah, the flowers went down well. And how was, you know, soup? I was like, yeah, it went down well. And what about the evening? What did you cook? And I just couldn't bring myself telling my mum that I'd cooked fish fingers, baked beans and ketchup. So I lied. I basically said, well, mum, I did this intricate fish dish with a bean salad and a tomato jus. That's honestly what I said. She's like, no. I'm so impressed. I'm like feeling dirty. I'm like, I'm lying. She's like, well, what fish? I'm like, haddock. I think it was haddock. And how did you make the tomato jus? And I'm like, reduction? Tomatoes? And anyway, the point of the story is that there's moments, even in the midst of like really rough seasons, where you take time out And very intentionally you say, we're going to remember this relationship. We're going to cherish this relationship. We're going to enjoy one another. Like, that is the Sabbath. That's what the Sabbath is. Once a week, you hit the pause button and you basically say, I want to hang out. I want to invest in this relationship because I know that this relationship leads me to life. Intimacy always leads to fruitfulness. That's the irony. Some of us are trying to be really, really productive, but you don't realize that actually rest is the key in that equation. Intimacy leads to fruitfulness. Sabbath is the means by which we live productive lives. This is the wisdom of Jesus very briefly then. He says this, I am the true vine and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch of me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it be even more fruitful. Remain in me. If you've got a Bible and it's yours, just underline the word remain, because this is the key verb. Remain in me and I'll remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. In the last few weeks, we've heard loads about remain, leave, lead, not leave, or whatever version. But interesting that this is the key verb right now. Jesus wants to say, if you want to live life fully, if you want to enjoy shalom, wholeness, well-being, deep-rooted peace, then you've got to learn to remain. You know, the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments, interestingly, are all about protecting the relationship with God. Do not worship idols. Do not dishonor the Lord's name. They're all about protecting that one relationship that will lead you to life. Remain. And the reality is, some of us can't do the Sabbath because we can't be still and we don't know how to do intimacy. And that's a major problem. And Jesus would say, I want to teach you, because this is going to be easy, but you're going to have to let me teach you. I want to teach you some unforced rhythms of grace. I want you to rest. Let me land with this then. Final point is Sabbath is a gift that reminds us of our future. It's like a foretaste. So when B and I got married, before we got married, we got engaged, and I gave B an engagement ring, which is simply a promise that in a few months' time, we're going to get married. And the Sabbath is like a promise of what's to come. So the rabbis, if they wanted to understand what a word meant, they would go back into the scriptures and find the first place where that verb, that word is used. And it's called the principle of first mention. You go back and find the first use of the word. First use of the word Sabbath in the Old Testament. Interesting. Comes in Exodus chapter 16. And Exodus chapter 16 is the story of when God had rescued his people from Egypt. So 10 plagues, Red Sea, you've got all of the drama. And as they're wandering through the desert, they get to the point where they're like, we are hungry, we are thirsty, we are peed off. And God, we're tempted just to go back to Egypt because we're not sure we're going to make it here in the wilderness. Could you just like intervene and help us out? And God says, fine. I'm going to help you out. I will rain down manna from heaven. Quite literally, bread is going to fall from the skies and you've got to pick it up. So every morning I want you to go out, pick up the manna. There will never be too much. There will never be not enough. There'll always be enough for everyone amongst the Jewish people. So every morning they go out and do that. And then God specifically says, on the day before the Sabbath, you're to collect twice the amount. I will rain down twice the amount. So I want you to collect twice the amount. So on the actual Sabbath, you can just be. And we can hang out and you can rest and remember that you're free and that you're rescued for the sake of relationship. And that's the first time this word Sabbath is used. Why is that important? Well, fast forward to the New Testament and to Jesus' teaching on prayer. This is the Lord's Prayer that many of us will be familiar with. Jesus says, when you pray, here's how you pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. That's the key. Give us today our daily bread. The Greek of that actual final verse is strange because what it actually says is give us today tomorrow's bread. That's what the Greek says. Give us today tomorrow's bread. That doesn't make any sense, right? Like the way we would understand it, like, what does that even mean, give us today tomorrow's bread? Well, it makes huge sense for the Jewish people because they remember Exodus 16. when God said, I've rescued you for rest and for the sake of relationship. On the day before the Sabbath, you're meant to collect twice the amount so that you can rest on the actual Sabbath. Like, what is Jesus saying? He's essentially saying, what is your tomorrow? Your tomorrow is heaven coming down and heaven and earth becoming one. Your tomorrow is there being no death, no grief, no crying, no pain, no sin, no sickness, no suffering. That's our future, right? So when we pray for the sick to experience healing, we're basically saying, God, would you give us a foretaste of what we know is going to happen anyway? Just give us a little foretaste of it. And what's essentially going on here is the Sabbath is an opportunity to taste our future, to taste deep rest, no anxiety, no drivenness, the deep knowledge that we're loved, incredible relationship with our friends, no brokenness, perfect harmony between us and God. And God says, that's your future. And it's phenomenal. But I want you to taste it now. And here's one of the ways you taste it. For one day a week, you switch off your phone and stop doing emails. And you hang out with me. And you do the things you love doing. And as you do all of that stuff, you're reminded that I'm free. No one's controlling me. And I'm loved. And I've been gifted with this phenomenal relationship. And I know what's to come. So I'm going to enjoy this day. I want to encourage you. The Sabbath will change your life. Not because I've said so. Because Jesus said so. If you want shalom, the pathway to shalom is Jesus. His wisdom is take a day to rest. Why don't we stand?